Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on reforming Social Security when we return. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the tax have now been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%, and by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th in order to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, the average American family will have to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what do you think that makes us? Now, this income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. The income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? For more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. The number again, 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about the license. Social Security acts as a license for you to work. If you want to test that, just walk into some place and make an application for employment. Go down to the Department of Employment and tell them you're looking for a job, and every time they ask you for a Social Security number. Now, if you really want to carry it a step further, just tell them I don't have one. And they'll tell you, if you don't have a Social Security number, you can't work here. And that's the bottom line. Then they'll direct you down to the post office or Social Security office or someplace and tell you, well, go down there and get a Social Security number and then come on back. Now, if you'll think about it, most of us got our Social Security numbers that way. I wanted to deliver newspapers for the Humboldt Standard in Eureka, California, and the route manager came out and interviewed my dad, and he said, well, does your boy have a Social Security number? And the answer was no. Well, you can't deliver papers without one. So if you want to work in trade, commerce, business, and industry in this country, you've got to have a Social Security number. Now, Social Security is voluntary. You don't have to get a number. There's no law that requires it. So most people will say, well, you got to have one or you'd starve to death. You couldn't work. And that's exactly what you saw in Revelation 13:16, wasn't it? If you don't have the mark of the beast, you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade. That's why I think the Social Security number is the mark of the beast. Many people think it's something else, but you know, that number attaches to you, and you can't buy, sell, or trade without it. So, now, that Social Security number acts as a license in order for you to work. Now, listen to this. The possession of a written instrument, such as an IRS 1040 form, a W-4 form, or Social Security number, providing for the payment of money, is the prima facie evidence that the debt contracted therein is unpaid. Now, when you file your taxes, you send in your 1040 form along with your check. You never get a receipt that says paid in full, and you don't get the 1040 form back either. Now, go to Northrop versus Knott, 46 Pacific 599. It's a California case. I'll tell you that story. Now, the IRS 1040 return is never surrendered after payment. This, then, is as a matter of common law. The common law of the states, which governs federal practice in the absence of federal law in the matter, if there is no federal statute or case to the contrary. Now, additionally, payment on the return, that is the 1040 form, implies a voluntary act of the debtor looking to the satisfaction in whole or in part of the demand against him. You'll see that in Detroit Company versus Smith, cited at 15 Northwest 39. And the tender of a written instrument, that is the 1040 form, the tender of that written instrument, the 1040 form, implies recognition of an underlying debt and is tendered in discharge of an existing debt. So when a 1040 form is filed, that person becomes a party to the Social Security franchise and an admission of a debt due to the federal government and a duty to file, pay, and provide information forever. unless a dissolution of that corporate existence is granted or we otherwise prove that a corporate or quasi-corporate existence or franchise does not exist. Now, by putting into practice our common law and refusing any government franchise in Social Security, unemployment insurance, and all government entitlements is the ticket that we need to reclaim our individual rights, property, and liberty as set out in Hale versus Hinkle. Remember that Hale versus Hinkle I cited for you last time? 201 U.S. 43. It's on page 74 is the key part of the story. So those who partake of a free lunch are not free, and it's hardly lack of due process for the government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Now, I mentioned that to you last time in Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. That's Wickard versus Filburn, 317 U.S. 111. Taxation is a reasonable means by which regulation may be effected. And you'll see that in Vesey Bank versus Fenno, 8 Wall 533. Now, it appears that regulation is intended to prevent poverty in our old age before or due to a loss of a job or a spouse or some other such calamity. Now, this is accomplished under the Social Security Act. And it should be observed that Social Security means private insecurity and finally social insecurity. So the form and operation of the law is false, and the true intent and operation of the law is the destruction of the individual and society and the nation of the United States of America. That's the ultimate end goal. That's the end game plan. Social Security is in a mode of self-destruct right now. And ultimately, Social Security is going to self-destruct. I pointed that out to you, I think, last time. You see, the baby boomers alone are going to double the number of recipients over the next 20 years, and during the next 20 years, the workforce is going to increase by 15%. Now, Dick Armey was on the other night. I think he was on Tucker Carlson, if I remember right. And he said, there's no Social Security Trust Fund. The money that's paid out of Social Security every month has to be paid in every month. So when you get to the point in 2018 is where they're projecting the first deficit, 2018. Shuck, that's only 13 years away, isn't it? Now, right now, Social Security is running a surplus because of the immense tax increase back in 1983. But Social Security has no money in it. It has a bunch of IOUs that says the United States government owes Social Security several trillion dollars. The United States government's broke, can't pay its bills, has to borrow to keep operating from year to year. Where in the hell are they going to get the $3 or $4 trillion to pay the Social Security debt? Well, the only place they can get it is from you. So you either got to pay higher taxes, or we'll just print the money and pay it out. But printing the money and paying it out just cheapens the money that's in circulation, so that just adds to higher prices and more inflation. If that's what you want, we'll get after it. That's why I got out of dollar-denominated currency and assets. And there's no point in dealing in dollars. They're not worth anything. To give you an illustration, a $19.30 dollar today is worth 3.5 cents. So it takes a dollar today to buy what 3.5 cents would buy in 1930. Now, I guess Americans wanted that, and that's what they got. But, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and that's what the point is. And Paul O'Neill pointed that out along with Dick Armey. He said, now, listen, the Social Security problem over here is a real problem. Now, the Democrats are telling us, no, that's no problem. Don't worry about it. Go back to sleep. And the president, at least, is acknowledging that there's a problem that needs to be solved. So I thought I'd just throw my $0.02 worth in here, and I'd tell you that I think there's a real problem there. In fact, I thought there was a real problem 25 years ago when I dropped out of Social Security. I've been recommending to my students, you know, if you want to pay the income tax and Social Security, get after it. But it takes a third of everything you create and produce. And all of you young people out there, you know, if you're under 40 years old, you haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of collecting anything. In fact, if you're under 50, I don't think you're going to collect anything. You got 15 more years. Just add 15 more years onto this thing over here, and that takes you up to 2018. You may collect a little something. But you're going to pay in a whole lot more than you're going to get out of it. And that's where this story has been for the last 10 or 15 years. You know, since about 1980 to 85, along in there somewhere, maybe 1990, if you pay in a dollar, you're going to get something less than a dollar back. Now, you couldn't pay into an insurance annuity and get back less than you paid in. But in Social Security, you can. And furthermore, not only will you get less dollars out, those dollars are going to buy less because of inflation. Social Security has got to be the worst rat hole to put your money into that I could ever imagine. I'm going to give you some numbers as we progress along. If there's a poorer investment, I don't know what it would be. I've never heard of anything. For instance, just to give you a quick illustration, I won't prove it right here, but let's suppose that you're a doctor, dentist, or you're an insurance broker or something on that order, and you're making $100,000 a year. You're paying in the maximum amount, which today is around $12,000 a year. Well, just multiply it out, partner. And after all, you know, if you're an insurance broker or you're an insurance or a real estate broker, you can add and subtract, can't you? Take $12,000 a year and just multiply that times 40 or 45, whatever your lifespan or your working lifespan is going to be. I'll just do it right here, 12,000 times 40, 480,000, just shy of a half a million. You're going to pay in $500,000, and that's in today's dollars of today's current law, which, of course, they keep raising and raising as time progresses along. So you're going to pay in $500,000. Now take today's current law and how much can you draw out? And the answer is around $1,200 a month. And we'll take 1,200 times 12, which is $14,400. Now take that times 10. That's $144,000. So you're going to pay in $500,000 and you're going to get $350,000 or $150,000 back. It means you're going to pay in $350,000 that you're not going to get back. You get no interest on it. Can't pass it on to your children. It's just gone. Now you tell me that that's not a tax now, huh? Well, that's a tax on a tax on a tax, isn't it? Now, I'll tell you what I'll do. You give me the same amount of money, and instead of $150,000, I'll give you $300,000 of it back. I'll only keep $180,000. I'll write you the same 120 checks that the Social Security people are going to do, and I'll only charge you $180,000 for them. That's a hell of a lot better deal than you're going to get out of Social Security. And any insurance company would make you an even better deal than that. And that's why Paul O'Neill said private accounts would make anybody, even the guy that makes minimum wage at McDonald's. I mean, you could go to work at McDonald's and work for 40 years paying in $1,770 a year. If you invested that at 5% interest in U.S. Treasuries, at the end of that period of time, you'd have $280,000, which would be paying you in the neighborhood of, I think it was $1,500 a month. More than if you, today's current law, more than the doctors and dentists are going to get. That's what you'd get out of your annuity if you did it privately. Somebody said, some Democrat said the other day, he said, yeah, but most people won't do that. So what's that, my problem in life? So what's that, my fault? You want me to pay in $500,000, give me back $150,000 so you can take care of some stumbled bum down on Skid Row because he can't look out for himself? You know, when America's Constitution was written, the Founding Fathers created a limited government for the purposes of government, not for the purposes of social welfare. So I'm not opposed to social welfare. If you people want to get involved in that, get after it. I don't want to get in the way of your happiness and success. Just count me out. And that's what I objected to, was the compulsory nature of Social Security. Now, they sent me to public school, indoctrinated me, and told me you have to do this. And I found out later that was a lie. You don't have to join Social Security at all. So when I found that out, I got the hell out, and I've been happy ever since. Let me tell you another little story here. When the Democrats are telling us that there's no problem, one of them was on Tucker the other day, he said, oh, it'll be several decades. I don't know what he means by several. 13 years doesn't sound like several decades to me, but you know, suppose it's two. Any program that is not self-sustaining forever is a Ponzi scheme. It is either self-sustaining or it isn't. And Social Security is not self-sustaining. It wasn't self-sustaining when it was created. The tax in 1935, when they enacted it, was 1%. By 1950, it was 2.25%. It kept growing steadily until today it's 15.3%. Now, what's that tell you? The tax has to constantly go up. It went from 1% to 2% to 4% to 8% to 16%. Now, that's five doublings. It'll go from 16 to 32 to 64 and 128. Boys and girls, before the tax hits 128% of everything that you create and produce, which is three more doublings, I predict Social Security is going to collapse. It's going to go into non-existence. And everything that you paid into, it's going to go into non-existence right along with it. So the president ought to be commended for at least taking on the problem. Now, can the president solve the problem? I'm sitting over here waiting for the president's proposals. I think he's whistling Dixie through a straw hat, because how do you cure the deficiency of a Ponzi scheme? Can you tell me that? How do you fix one of those? I don't think that it's fixable. That's my personal opinion. And since it's not fixable, why not scrap it? Get rid of it. And the sooner you do that, the sooner we can get on to something more intelligent. And somebody says, well, what are you going to do with all these old people out here? Well, then all those old people are going to have to fend for themselves. All those old people are the ones that voted the politicians into this mess, wasn't it? Now pay the piper. And it doesn't make any difference whether you drop it on them today or Social Security drops it on them 5, 10, 20 years from now. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. Mathematically, it can't work. There's a second factor that comes in here. When this thing started, you had 80 people paying in for everybody drawn out, dropped down to 45 to 1, 16 to 1, 3.2 to 1 just about, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And then now, today, it's 2 to 1 or 2.2 to 1. It's headed toward 1 to 1, and then pretty soon it'll be one person paying in for every two persons drawn out. Boys and girls, you're not going to have enough energy to work, produce, and pay in that kind of money to support 2, 4, 8, 16, or 32 other people. You're going to run out of energy at some point in time. That's where this thing is headed. Now, whether it's going to take another 50 years or 100 years for that to accomplish, you know, is academic. But for us to sit here today in 2005 and say, that's all right, let's take ours now and then let future generations fend for themselves, is a theft. Now, past generations have been stealing from us, and we're at the point now where we want to steal from future generations, and at some point in time, when the thing collapses, somebody gets ripped off. So I dropped out early on so that I wouldn't have to rip anybody off. I'm not paying in, I'm not drawing out, I'm happy with the investments that I made. Now, listen to what's going on here. the elderly to put phenomenal pressure on the budget in the next few years. Budget chief sees deficits pushed by Medicare and Medicaid growth. Now, the growth in mandatory federal spending driven by the inexorable aging of the American population means that well over half of all federal spending will go to entitlement programs for the elderly by the year 2015. That's only 10 years away. Over half. Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Holtz said Tuesday as he released a report giving his agency's forecast for the next 10 years. The growth in Medicare and Medicaid will place great pressure on the federal budget, he said, and at historic rates of growth, there's phenomenal budget pressure coming in future years from Medicare and Medicaid. The eventual result, according to Holtz, is likely to be much higher taxes. Okay, let's take a look at where we're at. The president just lowered taxes. They put this tax reform package in. That was to stimulate the economy. Do you remember that? See, when you tax the economy too much, people quit producing. People like George Gordon, I used to employ 30 people, produce $1 million a year. When the taxes get too high, when they were taking 20% of our gross product in taxes to 28 agencies, I closed the company and said, to hell with it, I'm not producing it anymore. Now, there's lots of people like me out there. I don't know how many, but now when you come along and you reduce those taxes and you say, well, Gordon, if you go back out and produce and hire people and employ people, we'll let you keep more of it. Well, that's a step in the right direction. It's hard to get people to work for nothing. And that's just where reality's at. And if you want me to invest my money into some project and employ people, I got to make something on that. And if I don't, I won't invest it and I won't employ anybody. Now, 20 years ago, I used to employ 30 people, produce $1 million a year, and pay about $200,000 a year in taxes. Today, I employ no one, produce nothing, and pay no tax. Now, is that good for you? Is that good for the economy? Is that good for America? And there's just, I don't know how many, but I'll bet you there's tens of thousands of guys out there just like me. I know one old buddy of mine, he's doing the same thing. He used to employ people, he used to be in the supermarket business, and he quit. He said, "Didn't tell with it, I've had it." Now, when your business people in the country do that, we don't live any poorer. Let me assure you that those of us that are businessmen that used to employ a lot of people and make a lot of money, we don't employ anybody now, and we still make a lot of money. So it doesn't affect us, but it affects all of you wage earners out there. In fact, that's why they're shipping your jobs off overseas. Government policy. Government tax policy. It's just so damn much cheaper to hire some guy in India to do your work for you than it is to hire you. That's what we're going to do. Now, it gets worse than that. The growth in Medicare and Medicaid will place great pressure on the federal budget, he said. At historic rates of growth, there's phenomenal budget pressure. Medicare spending will grow by an estimated 9% per year on average over the next 10 years. Now, that's according to the CBO. Now, while Medicaid, which serves the poor but also pays for many elderly people in nursing homes, will grow by 7% a year. And at the same time, the CBO figures that the economy itself will be growing by about 5% a year during the 2006-15 period. Now, that's pretty optimistic. I have not seen a 5% growth in our economy for many, many years. That's a phenomenon when it grows 5% a year. But Medicaid and Medicare are going to grow 7 to 9% a year, and their most optimistic projections is for the economy to grow 5%. Well, if you're going to fund that at the same rate that you're doing today and pay as you go, you got to have a 7 to 9% growth rate in the economy. That isn't going to happen. And you know that as well as I do. In fact, the economy right now is growing about 2 or 3%, and they're lying about that. I don't even see that when I analyze the numbers, but that's what they're telling us. And so what we're doing here is let's take their numbers and just crunch their numbers. And the thing isn't self-sustaining. It's like going into a bank, and you're the loan officer in the bank, and you say, "Where's your financial statement, partner?" And the guy produces his financial statement, and you read his numbers, and his numbers don't even give you a reasonable methodology for borrowing money and paying it back. Now, that's where the U.S. government is. Even their own numbers, which aren't even true, but even their own numbers in their most optimistic form can't sustain this debt or make the payments. Now, what are you going to do? Now, it's time for a few of us. Now, the vast majority of people, you know, you're not going to convince them one way or the other, and it's not my job to convince anybody. I don't care what you believe, and I don't care what you do. But in your own self-interest, you know, it would seem like to me that you'd want to take a look at this because it's your future, you know, the next 10, 15, 20 years. And how's this going to impact upon you, your job? How's this going to impact upon your mortgage and mortgage payments? How's this going to impact upon your 401k and so on down the line? Are you working today and you're putting all this money in your 401k and it's all going to be wiped out in an inflationary hyperinflation? Is that what you want? Seem like to me, you know, it's time to start looking around saying, well, geez, you know, I think the ship is going to hit the ice over there, and it's time for me to be figuring out a way to get off. Now, 3/5 of all federal outlays. By 2015, if the CBO forecast is correct, the three entitlement programs for the elderly will account for 55% of all federal outlays. Now, get this. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are going to take 55% of the federal budget. Now, that's a 30% hike over the 42% of federal spending that now goes into these three programs. So today, it takes 42% of the federal budget to finance these three programs. And it's going to grow by another 42, 52, 13% to 55% of the total federal budget over the next 10 years. Now, how do you like that? Now, isn't that a Ponzi scheme, and isn't that a crisis? I mean, if it's not a crisis, can you tell me, well, what is that? Are these numbers true, accurate, and correct, or is the budget office lying to us? Or is it those Democrats that are lying to us? Or is it the president's lying to us, or maybe all three of them? Ever wonder about that? In any event, how does that portend for you? You know, you're paying 16% in Social Security tax, 17% in income tax, then you got 12 other taxes. They total up to nearly 75% of everything you create and produce. Now I'm talking about people up here in the $100,000 range. Top tax bracket. If you're not in the top tax bracket, it doesn't take quite as much, but it's taking a bunch anyway. It takes over half. And you don't see that. You know, you pay your gasoline tax every time you fill up your tank, but you know, in our state here, I think that the gasoline tax is pushing 40 cents a gallon. Every time you put in 10 gallons of gas, you're paying $4. You know, 10 gallons of gas, $4 in tax. You know, you add that up at the end of the year, and you measure that up with your property taxes and your corporate tax and your income tax and Social Security taxes and capital gain tax. You know, there's 14 of these, and you just add all those up. Now, how much of the money that you earn every year is going to taxes? Well, add it up. Pay attention to what's going on around you. I think you'll be surprised. Now, the new prescription drug benefit that Congress enacted last year is going to add substantially to these federal outlays. By 2015, that's 10 years from now, the CBO forecasts that the taxpayers will be spending $174 billion on the drug entitlement, and the program will account for nearly one quarter of all Medicare expenditures. Now, contradicting an argument made by President Bush that the prescription drug benefit for older Americans will save money by helping people avoid costly surgery, Holt said, we have not found dramatic cost savings, and certainly not over a 10-year period, but he said the CBO would continue to investigate whether cost savings would, in fact, materialize. Persistently large federal deficits would have a corrosive and detrimental impact on the U.S. economy, and the U.S. cannot borrow to meet its needs forever, the CBO chief said, and at some point, much higher taxes seem unavoidable. Now, you see, these guys, every time that they've had a shortfall in Social Security, they just increase the taxes. So they increase the taxes from 1% to 2% to 4% to 8%, now it's 16%. And the solution that the Democrats are prescribing is we'll just raise taxes again. Well, okay. I think I pointed this out last time, but if I didn't, let me do it again. If you raise my taxes, I'm a businessman now, and you raise my taxes, I pass that on in higher prices in my product. That's all. And so does every other manufacturer. So does every other wholesaler, retailer, and businessman. He just adds it in. So if you think that you're getting something for nothing over here, let me assure you that you're getting absolutely what you're paying for. And if you want more and more Medicaid, more and more government benefits, it'll cost you more and more money. You'll have a poorer and poorer standard of living. You'll have less and less to live on, and you'll have more and more in taxes. Now, there's a hidden tax of 16%. Let me share that hidden tax with you and show you how that works. Anytime you buy something, the taxes that it costs to manufacture that product are added right into the product, right into the price. So when you buy a waterbed from me, you're paying all the payroll taxes that I paid to all of my employees. All those payroll taxes, every dollar's worth. And a little bit more to make sure that I didn't make a mistake and pay something out of my pocket. That's what the consumer is paying. So what happens here over a period of time, prices get to be so high that you can't afford a lot of these goods that you would like to buy. So then the only solution is, then you have to buy the foreign products that come from China. So you take less money and buy the foreign products, and then the American workers are unemployed. And unemployed workers are out here sucking off of the cash cow. They're not producing. And if they're not producing, they're not paying taxes. So that puts a higher tax burden on you. Which means then that you can purchase less and less and less. Your standard of living keeps going down, down, down. Now, you know that as well as I do. Your standard of living today is poorer than it was in 1955. And you haven't had a real wage increase since 1973. That was last year that we had a real wage increase. Now, you're making more dollars. But if you take a $1980 and compare it to a $2005, in 25 years, it has depreciated by half. And that's the half-life that we talk about with compound interest. So you got inflation that goes on at about, you know, 3-5% a year. And you just take that number from 1980 and you just add 5% compounded every year, and pretty soon the $2005 now takes $2 today to buy what $1 bought in 1980. Now that's where you're at. So and unless you're making more than twice as much as you made in 1980, you didn't get a salary or a wage increase. All right. So there's that story. Now I got to tell you a little story here, if I can find my paperwork. Maybe I won't find my paperwork and we'll tell you the story. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the opinions, the beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. And once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, let me pick up another piece of paper here and let's tell you a little bit more to this Social Security story. Or maybe I should title it the Social Security, Social Insecurity story. Now, if you remember, I told you that Social Security is voluntary. Voluntary. Let me show you that. When you send a rescission into Social Security, the Social Security Administration, not always, but many times, will send you a letter. And I'm looking at a stack of letters here that my students have forwarded to me that they have received. And there's probably 10 of these form letters that I've seen over and over again. So let me, I've underlined some of the key phrases in the letters. So let me just run through, you know, 5 or 6 of these letters and listen to this. Here's a letter from Social Security Administration to one of my students. It says, every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Did you know that? You know, if you don't want to work in a in employment covered by Social Security, you know, you could opt out of that. I did. I do. I avoid Social Security covered employment like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, I know you're going to say, well, I can't imagine anything that isn't covered by Social Security. I know of lots of things that are not covered by Social Security. I can't think of anything that I can't do. Well, there's probably a few things that I can't do because I don't have a Social Security number, but not very many. Here's the second one. There's no law requiring a person to apply for a Social Security number, and there is no section of Title 18 of the United States Code making it a crime not to have a Social Security number. Do you know that? Let me repeat that. There's no law requiring you to get a Social Security number, and there is no section of Title 18, that's our criminal code, of the United States Code that makes it a crime not to have a Social Security number. I don't have one. 14 million Americans don't have Social Security numbers. We're not criminals. Of course, we can't go get a job at General Motors. You know, I can't get a job down at Walmart or over at McDonald's, but who in the hell wants employment? There's no money in employment. You can make a living wage, maybe. And they tell me that you can't even make a living wage at McDonald's. You know, they're complaining about minimum wage being so poor. You know, they can't make a living wage. So I think that to make money, you ought to be thinking about something else, like buying, selling, and trading, or doing something. Here's the third letter. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. How do you like that? Here's another little kicker. In the same letter, it says, however, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. Now, remember, I told you that Social Security is a license for you to work. And your Social Security number is your taxpayer identification number, and that's voluntary. And you've heard that the income tax is voluntary. Well, of course it is. Now, here's the kicker. Once you got a Social Security number, you volunteered. Now, paying income tax is mandatory, just like joining the Army. See, joining the Army is voluntary. But once you go down and join the Army, once you sign the enlistment contract, what goes on after that is mandatory. So when that sergeant tells you, do this or do that, you better say, yes, sir, and do it, or else you're going to have a lot of trouble. And that's where most tax protesters are. See, they got a Social Security number, and they're taxpayer, and then they won't file and pay their taxes. They will not render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and then they get into trouble. Now remember, the Messiah told you to render to Caesar that which is Caesar's. Well, if you don't have a Social Security number, then you don't owe Caesar that income tax and Social Security, do you? And that's what Social Security tells us. And, of course, the courts also have some more to add to it. Now, listen to this. Here's a case that comes from Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. It's cited at 168 Fed 2nd 709. Let's write that down. Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Here's the site. It's 168 F2D Fed 2nd 709. Then turn to page 712 and read this. As they say in the Blue Room, read them and weep. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. No procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they are neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Unquote. Did you get that? What a statement. Again, that's Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, 168, Fed 2nd, 709. On page 712, I'll read it to you again. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. Well, then there's a group of people out here called non-taxpayers. I'm one of those. I'm one of those. I don't have a Social Security number. I don't have a taxpayer identification number. Now, it's voluntary, and I decided I don't want to volunteer, so I don't want to participate. Now, there's a downside to that. You know, what if I wanted to go to work for the government? What if I went to the FBI and said, hey, listen, I'd like to become an FBI agent, and I don't have a Social Security number? Well, and I can't become an FBI agent. What if I wanted to work at General Motors or Walmart or Wehrmacht or any place? I can't work there. I don't have a social security number. I don't have to have one. So that means I have to be able to make a living outside of employment, don't I? Outside of the system. And they went on to say, no procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, that is, with non-taxpayers, Congress does not assume to deal, and they, non-taxpayers, are neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Revenue laws don't attach to non-taxpayers. But you don't become a non-taxpayer by just saying, I'm not a taxpayer. You got to do something. Here's another story over here. To our knowledge, no organization can require an employer to provide or deny employment to people who refuse to disclose their social security numbers. Any problems that you as an individual have over employment for this reason is between the employer and his employee. An individual who does not wish to use a social security number can request his employer to enter the phrase religious objector, refuses to provide a social security number or some other appropriate remark in the space provided for the social security number when reporting earning. However, even if the employer agrees to do so, the individual must still pay Social Security taxes if the job is covered by Social Security. So if you're going to work for some company like Walmart and the job is covered by Social Security, well, then you got to pay Social Security. Why don't you think about getting into some kind of a business not covered by Social Security without a Social Security number so that you can be a non-taxpayer? I mean, that's a wild new concept, isn't it? And I wish I could take credit for that, but, you know, I'm not that smart, so I had to go to the courts, and the court said in Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, you know, here's the way this game is played. Now, those of us that don't have social security numbers are called religious objectors. As Mr. Jennings advised you, here's another letter here from Social Security. Your social security number and record will not be used at all unless you yourself activate the record by using it for employment or for some other purpose. So you're the one that initiates the use of social security by the use of the number. You know, somebody says, oh, you want to borrow money from the bank. Well, what's your social security number? And if you don't give it to us, we won't loan you any money. Or, you know, you want to get a job somewhere. Well, what's your social security number? And we won't hire you unless you give us a social security number. Now, I don't have one, and I live my life pretty successfully. I'm not complaining. I haven't had a number since 1984. So you're 9,404, 21 years now. And there isn't anything that I can think of in 21 years that I wanted to do that I couldn't do without one. And I saved a lot of money in the process. Now, I used to be a volunteer, and I used to file and pay my taxes just like everybody else. But, you know, one day I woke up and I said, well, is this really in my best interest? And my conclusion was that it wasn't in my best interest, so I quit. It's kind of like smoking dope, you know. One day you wake up and you say, well, is this in my best interest? I smoked a pack of Camel Studs, you know, every day. One day I woke up and said, I don't think this is in my best interest, so I quit. Well, why don't you think about doing the same thing for yourself? Now, as Mr. Jennings advised you in his July 13th letter, you should request present and future employers to enter the phrase religious objector in the space provided for a social security number when they report your wages and taxes. And you may show this letter to your employer to show that your request is valid. So here's a letter from the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, Social Security Administration. And they're telling this guy, well, in this case, it's a lady, dear Ms., why don't you put religious objector in there, you know, if you're one of those. All right, so there's a story on Social Security letters. I probably have another 20 of those. I'm not going to read them all to you. I just wanted to show you that Social Security is voluntary. Social Security is a license for you to work. And you have to have that license in order to work. Most of us want to work. In fact, George Bush, when he was running for election, he said, you Americans out there want jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what he told him. And, of course, if that's what you want, or jobs, 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 then you want Social Security because it's necessary for you to get a job. Now, I'm not looking for a job. I don't want employment. There's no money in employment, and because there's no money in it, I want to stay away from it. So I'm not interested in that at all. I'll tell you another little story here. It comes from a case called Diefendorf versus Galay. So if I dig through my pile of papers here and get Diefendorf, Guardian Ward. Gosh, here's a neat quotation from Secretary of State Colin Powell, Labor and Labor Relations, the Communist Manifesto. I'm going to bring you a bunch of good information here on the Social Security. Let's take a look here. Diefendorf versus Galay, as it relates to the income tax. Now, you know there's tax protesters out there, and tax protesters, they get pretty hot into the collar. They get pretty excited, you know, about this thing called the income tax. And so I'm not a tax protester, so I'll tell you that right now. I get credit for being a tax protester. I've been called a tax protester, you know. I've been called a lot of other things worse than that, but I'm not one of them. But I'm not opposed to them, so I don't want you to get mad at me and say, well, you know, you're a snitch or you're a government undercover agent or something like that. No, I'm not one of those either, but I'm not out here carrying placards around trying to abolish the income tax or the Federal Reserve. I mean, after all, that's what most Americans want, paper money and income tax. Now, here's a case out of Idaho back in the early 1930s. It's cited at 51 Idaho 619, and the participants are Diefendorf versus Galay. That's D-I-E-F-E-N-D-O-R-F versus G-A-L-L-E-T, Diefendorf versus Galay. And the Supreme Court of Idaho makes this statement concerning income. A lot of times people say, well, you know, the IRS code doesn't tell us what income is. Well, the Idaho Supreme Court does. Now listen to this. Here's the definition of income. It says income is defined as. So listen up now. Here's what income is. Income is defined as something. Got that? Income is something. So write that down. Income is something. And whatever this something is, it is derived from. So income is defined as something, and it's derived from property, labor, skill, ingenuity, or sound judgment, or from two or more in combination. So that's what income is. You got that right out of the Supreme Court of Idaho? No, you too. No. Now, when we get down to whatever the something is, we can identify it. The same meaning appears to have attached to the form or the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives. And we take judicial notice that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Income has never been assessed or taxed as property. So income is not property. Income is something that comes from property. Now, property you have a right to. Property is something that is attached to rights. Right? Now the court goes on to tell us a little bit more about this income thing. They tell us that income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income, presumably that's you, the state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it, and a tax thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. So it's a joint venture. It's a partnership between you and the state. Did you know that? Well, the Supreme Court of Idaho just explained it to you. Let me read it to you again. And listen up now. It's a pretty neat explanation. Income is. Remember that? Tax protesters, they walk in my door and they say, well, the tax code never defines income. Well, the courts have done it many times. Income is something. So now you know that it's something. And income is necessarily the product of. Here's what income is. It's the product of the joint efforts of the state and you, the recipient of the income. Isn't that just special? You and the state are in a partnership. Now, George Gordon and the state are not in any partnership. I used to have a partnership with the state, and the state was stealing so much from me so often and so fast, I couldn't keep up with it. And I said, oh, this isn't a very good program. I think I'll opt out. So I terminated my partnership with the state. You ever thought about that? You know, terminating your partnership? Now, the state furnishing the protection necessary. This is a protection racket. The income tax and Social Security is a protection racket. Well, that's what we call it when the mafia operates one. Now, when the state operates it, they call it Social Security. When the mafia or the Cosa Nostra operate it, it's called a protection racket. You see, the state furnishes the protection necessary to enable the recipient, that's you, to produce, receive, and enjoy it. And a tax thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. So you're a doctor, and you got a monopoly, and the state licenses you to be a doctor. And they let you open up your store on a corner. And if I go across the street and open up a store, they'll arrest me and jail me for practicing law or practicing medicine or practicing something without a license. That gives you the monopoly. And because you get this monopoly, you get to pay the income tax. See how that works? And that's because the state uses the police power of the state to guarantee you your monopoly in this criminal activity called medicine. Now, there are 15 professions, and all 15 professions are criminal activities. Lawyers are criminals. Doctors are criminals. Dentists are criminals. How do I know that? Well, just go to the legal dictionary and look up the word license. And a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So a doctor, what's the crime that the doctor wants to commit? He wants to violate the statute in Exodus 15:26. God says, I am your healer. Now the doctor in the state of Idaho comes along and says, no, that's a lie. God is not your healer. Marcus Welby, MD, is your healer, and he does that down here at Mercy Medical Center. So they license the doctor to violate Exodus 15:26 for profit and gain. The state then demands a portion cut from the income. That's the something that you're making, Doc. The something that you're making is profit and gain on commercial paper, which is also against the law. God told you, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. So you take credit cards, you know, MasterCard and Visa. You take Federal Reserve notes and checks in payment. Don't you, Doc? All right. So now here you are in competition against God, who says, I'm your healer. And so you said, no, I'm going to compete with God. I've got to create my own God, the state of Idaho, who's going to issue me a license, which is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. And I'm going to go out and compete with God at Mercy Medical Center. And I'm going to violate these laws, and I'm going to have to pay a portion of the ill-gotten gains, that's the profit or gain, that I make to the state to keep anybody else from competing with me. That's because I want this monopoly for myself. That's why people want licenses. Plumbers want licenses. Electricians want licenses. Doctors want licenses. Everybody wants a license because they want the police power of the state, which comes in and regulates that industry to keep all of the free market competitors out. We do not want supply and demand, and we do not want a free marketplace. And so we eliminate it. Now, much confusion of thought arises from regarding the income tax as a tax that is levied upon or attaches to property as such, irrespective of the person sought to be taxed. It is the recipient of the income that is taxed, Doc. It's you, the recipient of the income, that's taxed, not his property. Not taxing your property, Doc. And the vital question in each case is, has the person sought to be taxed received an income during the tax year? So I woke up to this one day and I said, I'm going to avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And so far I've been doing that successfully. So I concentrate on property and I avoid income. And that's because income is something. So I'm avoiding something called income, which is taxed and taxable. But it's not property. So the opposite to income is property. Now why don't we concentrate on more property and less income? And I think we'd have a whole lot less problem. Now, of course, if we don't have Social Security, when we get to be old folks, how are we going to live? Well, now, if you had $1 million, you know, if you had invested your money or some portion thereof when you were young, I told you about Henry, didn't I? Well, Henry Moore. And Henry was an electrician. He's the same age as I am, was in the ninth grade with me, about 1955. Today, he owns 6 or 7 houses in Eureka, California. He built those houses, owns them all free and clear, and he's making income off them. Does he need Social Security? No, he took care of himself. He took some of his money and he went out and invested it in real estate. He could have invested in stocks and bonds or 15 other things. And if you and I and everybody else were allowed to do the same thing when we got to be 65 years old, we'd be in the same boat that our great-granddaddies and great-great-great-granddaddies were in 1750, 1850, and 1950. Before Social Security, there was life. And I predict that there will be life after Social Security. Social Security is an aberration that is coming to an end. And when it comes to an end, there are a lot of people going to lose a lot of money, lose a lot of their productivity, lose a lot of their life savings. You ought to work hard and see if you can't minimize that loss. It'll probably be in your best interest. All right, so that's the case called Diefendorf versus Galay. I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. Give you a couple of caveats and a reminder here. You know, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's a signal that says time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.